Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Getting Spooky with Knox. I am your host, Knox, and today we're back with a brand new true crime episode on the Texarkana Moonlight Murders. Now, before we begin, I have a couple things that I want to say. One is I finally have an actual microphone, and I'm not using my phone's microphone anymore. So if I sound different, that's probably why. But other than that, nothing really new in the realm of the podcast. No major announcements to make. The second thing is actually a little fun fact. I've actually driven through Texarkana on my way to Texas about 2 years ago. My dad and I thought we would never hit the Texas border because we'd been driving for several hours at that point. And when we went through Texarkana, I actually had no idea about these murders because they happened in the 40s. So they happened a while ago. It wasn't like a recent thing that was in like the headlines or on news articles online or things like that. So I had no idea what had taken place here when I drove through with my dad. But I just thought it was kind of interesting that I've technically been here before. Just I didn't stay. I didn't go walk around and visit. We were too busy trying to get to our destination because we were so tired. We've been driving for 16 hours, I think, at this point, because I think we had about 2 hours left. Don't quote me on that. I'm not exactly sure. I just know that we'd been in the car for a really long time. So I thought that was interesting. And now I'm going to tell you about the murders. So, trigger warning, I mentioned sexual assault, but I try not to go into graphic detail. If this is distressing to you, then please consider not listening to this episode. Your mental health is more important to me than you listening to this episode. Let's dive in, shall we? This took place in the 1940s, in 1946 to be exact, and happened in the span of about 3 months. Young couples were attacked as they were parked on Lover's Lane on the Texas side of town. There were three couples to be exact, and the last incident actually took place at a farmhouse on the Arkansas side. Three people were seriously wounded and five had been shot dead. If they could afford it and their husbands are out of town, women with money would pack up their families and their things and stay at a hotel. If you want a specific hotel, then they stayed at the Hotel Grimm, aptly named. And it's still open to this day. Others put up pots and pans on wire around their homes and properties to let them know if someone was trying to sneak onto their lands or into their homes. And if someone owned a gun, they would sleep with a loaded one beside their bed. If they had children, then they made makeshift beds beside their own so they knew that their children were safe. I can't imagine living in this type of fear. The drastic measures that people took to make sure that they and their families were safe from this person really show how deep the fear ran. The Texarkana Gazette named the killer the Phantom Killer since no one knew who he was. Movies, books, and urban legends have been born because of the Texarkana Killer. The Town That Dreaded Sundown was released in 1976 and is based on the murders, and there was even a remake of the movie in 2014. Texas Department of Public Safety had dubbed these murders as, quote, the number one unsolved murder case in Texas history, end quote. These crimes are still unsolved to this day, and no one knows the reason why a person would do this. So who were the murder victims? February 22, 1946 was the date of the first attack. Jimmy Hollins, age 25, and his girlfriend Mary Jean Laurie, age 19, had gone to see a movie that night, and after they decided to take a trip to Lover's Lane. They say that the man who attacked them had been wearing a white hood with holes for eyes, almost like a pillowcase covering the person's head. He appeared at the driver's side door and shined a flashlight inside. Jimmy thought that the man was trying to prank someone and told the man that he had the wrong people, but the man responded with, quote, I don't want to kill you, fellow, so do what I say, end quote. Both Jimmy and Mary were then forced out of the car, and the man told Jimmy to take his pants off. Once he did that, the man then struck Jimmy in the head with a pistol twice. Mary later told police that the sound had been so loud that she originally thought that Jimmy had been shot by the man, but all that he had done was fracture Jimmy's skull. Mary then thought that the man meant to rob them, and she showed Jimmy's wallet to prove that they didn't have any money to spare, but the man just hit her as well. He then told her to run, and when she tried to flee to a ditch, he told her to go in a different direction. She did, and found another parked car, but there was no one there. The man had caught up and asked her why she had been running away from him. She told him that it's what he had instructed her to do, and he called her a liar. He then proceeded to sexually assault her with the barrel of his pistol. after Mary once again ran, and this time she made it to a house. She called the police after she woke the people in the house. Jimmy had then regained consciousness and flagged someone down. They left Jimmy and went to a funeral home that was nearby to call the police. They arrived on the scene, but the man had already left the area. Both managed to survive the attack. They gave reports to the police, but their descriptions of the man were not matching. Mary claimed that he had a white bag over his head with holes for his eyes and a mouth, and that he was African American. Jimmy said that the man was white, and he thought that he was around 30 years old. They both agreed that the man was around 6 feet in height. The police thought that they both knew who the man was, but was covering for him. I don't think that this was the case. I think they both went through something traumatic and didn't know what exactly had happened to them or who had attacked them. So their brains could have been getting something mixed up and they were just scared. Of course they would be. They had just gone through something really traumatic. So I don't think that they were covering for anybody. I think that they were just really traumatized by the events and they weren't sure who had attacked them. March 24th, 1946, was when the next attack occurred. A man named Richard L. Griffin, age 29, and his new girlfriend, Polly Ann Moore, age 17, were found dead on Lover's Lane near a club known as Club Dallas. They were found by a passing motorist in Richard's 1941 Oldsmobile. The person initially thought that Richard and Polly were sleeping. Richard was found in between the front seats, his head resting on his hands, and his pockets looked like someone had went through them and pulled them out when they couldn't find anything. Polly was face down in the back seat, but there was evidence that suggested she had been killed outside the car while on a blanket and then put back in the car in the position she had been found in. Both of them were still fully clothed, and both had been shot in the back of the head once. A .32 cartridge shell was found at the scene and was believed to have been shot from a Colt pistol that had been wrapped in a blanket. Why wrapped in a blanket? My theory is to muffle the sound of the gunshot. The blanket acted as a silencer, but maybe there was another reason. The FBI worked alongside both Arkansas and Texas police. On March 27th, anywhere from 50 to 60 people had been brought in and questioned. Most were from Club Dallas, either employees or people that had been there the night of the murder. On March 30th, the police offered a $500 reward for any new information about what had happened to Richard and Polly. April 13th, 1946, is the beginning of what happens next. Betty Jo Booker, age 15, had been playing with her band, the Rhythmers, at the VFW Club, which was a weekly thing for them. Paul Martin, age 17, was a friend of Betty's, and he came to pick her up on Sunday, April 14th, and that was the last time either of them were seen alive. This was around 1:30 in the morning. Paul was found at 6 a.m. on April 14th by a married couple named Mr. and Mrs. G.H. Weaver, along with their son. Paul was lying on his side and had been shot 4 times, one through his nose, then through the left 4th rib, then through his right hand, and then through his neck. Betty Jo was found 2 miles away behind a tree. She was lying on her back and was fully clothed. She had been shot 2 times, once in the chest and then once in the face, the same weapon as the first murder. Paul's 1946 Ford Club Coupe was discovered about 3 miles away from Betty Jo. The authorities don't know who was shot first, but both of them had given their captor a struggle. The reward went from $500 to $1,700 if information about who did this to the 4 people was brought forth. May 3, 1946 is the last crime that was committed. Virgil Starks, age 37, was in his home and listening to his favorite radio show. His wife, Katie Starks, age 36, had given him a heat pad for his back. Virgil was sitting in the sitting room, and Katie was lying in her bed when she heard something outside. She then asked Virgil to turn the radio down. With the radio lower, he began reading the paper, and he was shot 2 times in the back of his head. Katie didn't hear the gunshots, but she heard what sounded like breaking glass, which makes sense since Virgil was shot through a window. Thinking that Virgil had dropped something, she went to see what was going on. She saw Virgil stand up and then slump back down into his chair. She went to the phone to call someone when she was shot through the same window. She was shot in the face. One of the bullets went into her right cheek and exited right below her left ear. The other one hit just below her lips and broke her jaw. She fell to her knees but got back up and tried going into the living room to get the pistol there. She then heard the person trying to get in through the screen porch and then through the kitchen window. She managed to escape and ran to her sister and brother-in-law's house that was across the road. They weren't home, so she ran to the neighbor known as V. Prater, told him that Virgil was dead, and then she collapsed. Prater used his rifle to shoot into the air and summoned yet another neighbor, Elmer Taylor. Prater told him to bring his car because Virgil and Katie had been shot. Elmer Prater, Prater's wife, and their child took Katie to Michael Meager Hospital. She managed to survive her injuries. Searches were conducted in order to try and find the mysterious figure that had been haunting the Texarkana area, but nothing ever came to fruition, and the killer was never brought to justice. And there you have it, the Texarkana Moonlight Murders. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to request a true crime, paranormal event, urban legends, mythological monsters, conspiracy theories, or secret societies episode, then spookywithme@gmail.com, my Twitter @SpookyKnox, my Facebook Knox Productions, or through my website, which is linked in both my Facebook and Twitter profiles. Next week, we're back with a brand new paranormal episode on the Bermuda Triangle. I hope y'all are having a great week, and I'll talk to y'all next time. Bye.